Hello, my name is Brian Novoselsky, and welcome to the Over the Counter podcast. Today, we're joined by Dwayne Jones, Regional Pharmacy Supervisor and Clinical Program Director at Harps Food Stores. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today, Dwayne.
Thank you very much, Brian. Thank you for having me here.
Awesome. So today, we're going to be discussing non-opioid alternatives for treating acute and chronic pain, while also taking a look at the Johns Hopkins Perioperative Pain Program and what initiatives like these are achieving in the pain management space today. So really, to start us off, Dwayne, can you just explain what are the primary non-opioid pharmacological and non-drug treatments that are available for managing acute or chronic pain?
So Brian, the mainstays that have been in over-the-counter medications or non-opioids are the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, Tylenol. We also have some prescription items like meloxicam that have been the mainstay for pain management and pain therapy in the past, and they're still very, very effective for the majority of pain, whether it's post-op or post-dental, and still recommended for that. There's also a class of medication and anticonvulsants like gabapentin that used to help block nerve pain as well.
Awesome. Cool. Appreciate you laying the groundwork for really what's out there today. So we'll definitely talk a little bit about kind of opioids, how they relate to non-opioid treatments, and then really get into the Johns Hopkins pain program. But for starters, what have been the continued issues regarding the use of opioids for pain management? How has the opioid space opened the door for non-opioid treatments?
So it's really unfortunate that we've had the opioid crisis within this country. A lot of bad information was given on behalf of some companies for their own financial benefit that has been detrimental to the health of the patients in this country. And basically, you know, we go back to what we've been preaching here for a long time. We have to put patients back at the center of patient care to be able to have healthier patients and reduce healthcare costs. The opioid crisis has cost this country billions of dollars, and unfortunately, have cost millions of lives in this country, needlessly so. And now that we have exposed that they really are not effective, in the most part, for treating pain, we're still in this hangover effect in this country from that crisis. It's like we use them, and it's like, what else do we use? And to me, it's almost like going back to the old Wild Wild West, because the opioids, all they do is they just make you incoherent. They make you feel numb, where you really just don't care. It's like the old Wild Wild West. They give you a shot of whiskey, take the bullet out. I mean, really, it's that simple, because it really doesn't do a whole lot as far as the etiology of pain. And so another thing that we focus on a lot is we have to get back to what is the underlying cause of this pain. And I think that's where Johns Hopkins really did a really good job, because if we find out what the root cause of the pain is, then they're more effective in treating it. And if you're throwing opioids at it, it's just like, you know, getting somebody drunk, like I said back years ago, and taking out a bullet. So now that we know that, and now that we're aware of the detrimental effects that it's had, we're still reeling from that, and still estimated that probably, what I've seen from the studies with Johns Hopkins, 1 in 16 people still get addicted from post-op pain. And I happen to work in a drug addiction facility. And so I see that 50% of our patients are there that were addicted innocently post-op or post-trauma. So we're still reeling from that. What do we learn from that? Well, we learned that there's a better way. I mean, the worst thing you can do for a patient, if they're in pain, whether it's post-op, whether it's trauma, is give them something like an opioid that's going to make them euphoric. They're going to go home and sit. That's the worst thing you can do. For pain, you actually need to move. We need to have circulation of oxygen and blood flow around the areas for the body to heal. And that is, I mean, I draw on one of my own personal experiences where I had a meniscus replacement or a tear in my knee and had that removed. And I said, please don't give me an opioid. Just give me a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. So unfortunately, I got an opioid. I didn't take it. I took my anti-inflammatory. 2 hours I'm up walking on my knee as I was told to do. The thing about post-op is we need patients to understand that pain is necessary for us to be able to tell your healing process, how you're maturing within that healing process. Secondly, We need to make sure that you feel that pain so that you don't overexert yourself and damage yourself and wind up back in the hospital again. Well, that was the whole fallacy of the opioids. As I said, this is great. It's going to help. These people are not going to be in pain, but it did more harm than good. So now we are still trying to get this message out to prescribers to say that should not be first line of therapy. And in my tenure in pharmacy, I have said for all along, I think ketorolac should be number one line for pain therapy. I think for acute pain, that should be number one because it's a great pain reliever. You don't need it for more than a couple of days, especially post-op, and then you don't have the addiction potential. So I had the opportunity years ago. I was on a panel in Baltimore, and the speaker that came up after that was Marty McCary from Johns Hopkins. He talked about how they had taken their post-op pain protocol and revised all of it, got a group of 20 to 30 healthcare professionals together and said, do you think that you need an opioid for this surgery, for this one and this one? And he said, I remember my dad had his gallbladder out and he had took ibuprofen and he did just fine. And he said, as a chief surgeon, I'd remove a lot of gallbladders, and yet they told me I need to give them an opioid. Well, the result was, no, we don't need opioids for these treatments. We need to start with first-line non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. Their post-op pain protocol then says ketorolac is first-line injection after surgery. Then we use non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And if we fail on all of these as a last resort, we give them the lowest dose of an opioid for 2 days until we get them to the point that now we can start to rehab them. So that's been my experience, and I'm very passionate about this because I hate to see the detrimental effect that it has on patients, needlessly so. I mean, dentists used to be the number one source for teenage addiction and opioids because they prescribed opioids every time after a dental procedure. American Dental Association says today they're not effective. And if you stop and think about it, just from the underlying cause of the pain, which we need to get back to, what's the evidence base for this, is that if I use a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory and it reduces inflammation in around the nerve endings, it's going to reduce pain, and it's not addictive. So now we come full circle. Because of this travesty that's happened, it's caused us to have to focus on what is the appropriate therapy and what are we doing on behalf of that patient. Here again, I go back to say, let's put the patient back at the center of care. And if we're looking at what's in the best interest of that patient all around, from the pain therapy to being able to measure their healing process, then we need some advanced education to them to let them know, expect this level of pain. We're not going to get you, we won't let you get into excruciating pain. But if we have proper therapies in place, then we give them better care and reduce their chances of becoming addicted.
Awesome. Yeah, I love that. I think that was perfectly put, really helping us understand all of the things that have been occurring with the opioid crisis up until now and how I feel like healthcare is really, not just recently, but really now understanding that there's a whole course correction that's kind of needed to happen. Yeah, I think that was like the perfect answer to really just explain like where everything has come with, you know, the non-opioids and the opioids and kind of
come full circle.
Yeah, where it should be going now. And
absolutely.
Appreciate like the real world examples, stuff like that.
Sure.
Cool.
Sure.
Yeah, so definitely going to dive into the Johns Hopkins. But before talking about the program, I just wanted to understand if are there newer non-opioid treatments in the pain management space that have made noise more recently? And like, do you expect them to kind of evolve in the near future? I know there has been some noise, but can you kind of like help us
There's
understand?
Journavx is a new one that's out. And, you know, it really is no better than a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. And it's much more expensive. I mean, you're talking about $500 for a 30-day supply or for 30 tablets. And yet it still is not any more effective than ketorolac as first line or any of the other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. So the basically is we don't need to be looking for new medications. We need to go back to using the tried, proven methods that are effective. Instead of saying, okay, we have a new product for you that you can use. No, let's just go back and use the established products that are on the market, the medications that are there that are effective, and stop trying to find this new innovative approach to pain management when you've got a solution in place. And then we need to go back to utilizing that and then educating the patients. That's one thing that we really need to focus on more in healthcare today is making the patient educated about what their disease state is, what's happening, what to expect whenever you're through, and then how to let us know if you're not healing properly. If you are having more pain, truly having more pain, then there's something that we need to look at. We need to find out what that etiology is.
Awesome. Yeah. So very much so, just moving away from, you know, that one size fits all solution to where healthcare should be going, as far as focusing on the patient and, you know, their needs, because so many different conversations like these, whether we're talking about technology and pharmacy or this stuff, we're trying to make the patient's lives better. So obviously, that's a great way to.
And I think that's one thing that Dr. McCary really discovered when he started looking into this, is there's not a one size fits all, you know. And then there are a lot of things that have contributed to this. One is that, you know, you go to the hospital, they expect you to be happy. They want you to make sure that you don't have any pain. And they were measured by that to a certain degree. So that was one of the culprits, is that, you know, there was this need to make sure that you don't have any pain and that you're comfortable in the hospital. We don't want you to be unhappy because we're going to get dinged for that. We're going to get fined for that. That's totally the incorrect thought process that needs to happen. What needs to happen is, are you healthy? Are you recovering? Are you recuperating? Are we doing our job to educate you? Did we do our surgery correctly? If there was something that happened in that, because we have to treat every patient as an individual. And we treat that patient individual, and then we start to see, okay, well, if this therapy is not working, maybe there's something else that's happening. Maybe there's a nerve pain here that's causing you some problems. So let's treat that with a gabapentin or one of these medications that's going to help block that nerve until we can get you rehabbed, because rehab is so important in the success of the surgery post-op. And that's the one thing I love about the Johns Hopkins program, is it really is perioperative, and it is a very unique program. Unfortunately, it's unique because we should have been embracing this all along. But nonetheless, now we're here. Now we see that this is actually a very effective way to help patients rehab and become effective and very, very functional in society after the surgery.
Awesome. Yeah. So let's just dive into it. So kind of what is, like, just the general mission of the Johns Hopkins perioperative pain program, and what specific goals does it set for patients that are on chronic opioid therapies?
So perioperative is to define that or to understand it. It's different. In the past, we were looking at pre-op, post-op. We were looking at pre-op, operative, and post-op, and then treating that separately. Today, they treat it all together. So let's educate the patient as to what. Let's do an assessment first to see where they are. If we have patients that are on a chronic opioid now, how do we taper them before surgery? How do we educate them to what to expect after the surgery? What do we do during the surgery that's going to also lead into the post-op treatment as well? So it's a multidisciplinary approach to treating this patient's pain. And we incorporate several different professions in this, even psychiatrists, because if you have somebody that has an underlying psychiatric condition that's going to make them more exposed to addiction, more exposed to being susceptible to the addiction from an opioid, we need to know that, and we need to be able to be aware of that going into it, so then we can prepare pre-op, op, and post-op, and then we can triage them accordingly. And that's the beauty of their program, is it's a multidisciplinary approach to that pain. And here again, the patient becomes a center of care. And we look at this patient, we work with the patient as according to their needs prescribe, not to what we prescribe is what we think they need as this standardized patient. We treat them as an individual. And that's the beauty of their program. And it's been extremely effective.
Awesome. Yeah, that's obviously wonderful to hear, and definitely a good segue, kind of what you touched on in the multidisciplinary kind of approach. Definitely want to talk about that, you know, pharmacist role and all that good stuff. So how does the program utilize this multidisciplinary transitional care model to really coordinate patient care?
So then you have transition to care. And within their multidisciplinary approach, they'll actually follow this patient post-op from up to 6 months, to make sure that they're rehabbing properly, making sure that they're actually going through with their physical therapy, make sure that they're actually getting their joints, their body back to condition to where it was before the surgery. And that takes some time, some education with that patient. And so as we look at that approach, we've looked at transition of care for many years within our practices, how we can help them as pharmacists, how we can help them to understand what's happening and how they can help themselves to heal better. Like I said earlier on, the worst thing we can do is give them medication and tell them to go home and sit. You know, like I said, I had my knee surgery. I'm up walking on it 2 hours afterwards because we need to condition your body. We've got to add that blood flow. We've got to have oxygen flow into that area for your body to heal. So we're going to help your body heal. Your body wants to heal anyway. And so if we give you medication that prevents that, then it's counterproductive. And we don't want that to happen. So it's an individualized approach. They actually now have developed an entire chronic pain management system within Johns Hopkins, where they manage these patients, help taper them off opioids if they're on them, and then give them alternative means of handling that pain and treating that pain and successfully doing it. I mean, there's even acupuncture can even come into play within this multidisciplinary approach. Here again, we're looking at that patient and what the cause is. And you know, you have situations where people have had tremendous trauma, they've had accidents, they've had multiple surgeries. There's really issues there that we need to deal with that particular individual. And as we put that patient back at the center of care, we can do that, but we don't treat every patient that way. And that's why we're in the problem we're in, is because every patient's been treated the same. And so lack of knowledge of opioids and the effect on opioids has caused this problem. There is a clinical entity out there, and it's called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, which most people don't understand. I remember whenever I was in our clinical group in our residency, I mentioned this one day, and one of the clinical people told me that they thought I was just making this term up because they hadn't heard this. They didn't teach us that in school. And they started looking it up and said, it's real. What happens is the more opioids you give them, the more sensitive they become to pain, and their pain actually grows. Well, we have had many instances where we've had patients that we started to taper them off of their opioids. They start feeling better, and then they say, I want to get off of these completely. And then we're able to help them taper their dose down and get their dose down. Sometimes it leads to, you have to have a substance abuse therapy involved with them. They have to go to counseling. But then we can get them completely off of it, and now they're completely functional in society again. And I can't say how many people have come up and said, thank you very much. I feel so much better. But that is because that knowledge is not out in the marketplace, in the marketplace, I say, but in our profession, to understand that that's a real entity. And if your patients are saying that they're in more pain, maybe it's because they're on too much pain medication and we need to start tapering them off. And there's a proper way to do that. And we've done it. We had a lot of a pushback in our company whenever we established our opioid policy. I said, we are going to follow CDC guidelines, and we're going to reduce people down below 90 morphine milligram equivalents because we had so many that were above it. I had physicians call me, and one wrote me a letter. Another one called me and said, thank you for taking a stand. We need some guidance and direction. So that's what I love about the Johns Hopkins program, and what Dr. McCary did is that he had developed protocols and systems in place that unfortunately hadn't been there before. And now that we've proven the success of it, it's something that I would really hope and wish that all the professions, all the prescribers across the country would start to embrace that and realize there is a better way. And just because we've always done it this way, that's not a good excuse to continue to do what you're doing, because I don't have a healthier patient at the end of the day. If I'm doing something, and maybe it's completely different therapy than what I've done in the past, but if my patient's getting better and they're happy with it and they're saying, thank you, I never wanted to be on this to begin with, then we're doing the right thing. And that's what we've got to start focusing on in healthcare. Again, I'll say it 100 times, put that patient back at the center.
Yeah, very much agree. I meet with people on a weekly basis to kind of tackle these like overarching healthcare challenges, but I feel like more so now than ever, like we really are kind of tackling those issues and identifying, you know, the education gaps and kind of the understanding and of medications and all those good things. To me, it really seems like kind of that one size fits all approach that we talked about, moving away from that and really like the caregivers and the providers actually like taking accountability for how they treat patients and how they move them along from, you know, point A to all the way to the end to actually feeling healthy and cared for.
Absolutely. The purpose of the surgery, the purpose of this intervention is to make them healthier and more viable in the community. I have a personal situation where my brother had a similar surgery, knee surgery that I had back when he was in high school. He was given opioids, unfortunately became addicted, unfortunately wound up homeless on the street there for a while. And so that it's really personal for me, too. And I think if you talk to people, the more people I've talked to, there's somebody in their life somewhere that was subjected to this, and needlessly so, and sadly so. And so now that we've got the knowledge, like you said, now that we're starting to educate and now we know that this is an evidence-based therapy that's successful, we need to start embracing it. And I challenge every healthcare professional, anybody that listens to this webinar, this podcast, to please, the data's out there, the research is out there. Just follow what Johns Hopkins has done. I love the fact that there's such a reputable institution that we can have them that are setting the stage, setting the protocols for the rest of us to follow. And they've got tried and proven successes. There's no reason not to embrace it. Is it difficult to have that conversation with the patient that's on this medication that's addicted? It is difficult, but you also have to remember that if you have a patient that's addicted, they're not communicating with you or rationalizing with their normal mind. They're rationalizing with an addicted mind. And all they know, if you really understand addiction, is I'll do anything to get that drug. Just give me that drug. So if we start tapering them off gradually, then we can tell them we are involved in an intervention that's going to make you a healthier individual, that's going to make you more viable. One of the things that the travesties about opioid and this opioid crisis is the tremendous burden that it's put on all of our communities in this country. I mean, because you wind up with an addict that wind up either within a divorce situation, theft situation, wind up in court, all these things, that's a burden on every single community in this country that we don't need, and it's needlessly so. So we need to start embracing more evidence-based therapies when it comes to pain management, tried and proven techniques that you can employ every day. Like I said, the American Dental Association says there's no need for an opioid now because it really is not effective in treating the pain. Well then, but we still see them prescribed. You know, so as a pharmacist role, we, according to the DEA, we do have a corresponding responsibility for that patient when it comes to opioid therapy. So we do step in and we teach the patient. We tell them this is what is necessary for you to become healthier. And in doing that, you develop trust, you develop a relationship, and now you can rehab that patient and help to rehab them, guide them to proper therapies that's going to actually help them in the long run.
Awesome. Yeah, perfectly put. Obviously, it's one of the most well-known and talked about issues within healthcare.
And we have decreased the number of overdose deaths in this country, but it's still 45,000 people a year that die from opioid overdose. And a thing I tell our patients is that, you know, overdose death is not dramatic. It's just respiratory suppression. You go to sleep and don't wake up. And so there's no advance notice that you're gonna overdose. It's just, and then the opioids cause confusion. You don't remember if you took one or not, and you take another one, and that winds up, you know, unfortunately, in an overdose death. That's why they're called accidental overdose, because you never intended that to happen. And that's the sad part about all of this. And it's 100% avoidable and preventable.
Yeah, very much so. But like you said, like the data, the evidence is out there, and it's only kind of bolstering up, and kind of like I said previously, like course correcting and making these outcomes better going forward. Awesome. Yeah. So really kind of, I really appreciate all the insights. Like this has been a wonderful conversation. I think we could sit here all day. I kind of just wanted to touch one last bit on the pain program and how that can really like drive health systems and healthcare as a whole forward. So do you believe that programs like these are key in correcting the treatment of pain in the US, or do you think that something else more systemic kind of needs to happen in order to introduce real change? Obviously, programs like these, like they are making a world of a difference, but do you think like kind of some other shoe needs to drop within that aspect?
I think if we will just embrace it and actually start to implement these therapies is where we make a difference. And it's not easy oftentimes if you have been in the habit of prescribing these opioids to change your method and your therapies. But I think as we start to see protocols, and that's what Dr. McCary really, really found out, is that it's sad we haven't had these protocols in place. But if you stop and think about it, most of healthcare today and most prescribing really doesn't follow a protocol. And that's where we get into a problem, is that those protocols are not established in individual practices as to how we should follow this protocol in this particular situation. And understanding that there's a shortage of physicians today in this country, a shortage of practitioners, and they're inundated. I mean, the average practitioner today sees 22 patients a day, and that's a lot. Sometimes they'll see up to 30, but that's a lot. And so you have to really stop and say, I have a limited amount of time with this patient. How am I going to make the most of this time and following a protocol for them and start to educate them? Educating patients is the most important thing we can do in the future to make this change, because patients come to you wholly trusting you to give them the proper advice. If you're just following old bad habits and you're just prescribing and treating symptoms, you're not taking care of that patient's needs and you're not educating them. They trust you. We need to be trustworthy providers and provide them with good information and explain to them why I'm giving them this medication, what you can expect it to do, and why you need to be taking it and how you should take it. Those are very, very important key factors moving forward. It's hard to write a protocol for that, but if we did, then practice would change all across this country. And you've got the evidence now of the success of it. It's a matter of, let's start employing that in our practices every day. It's going to be a challenge from the patients that you've been prescribing this just simply because they've always been on it. I have a lot of practitioners that say, well, I got this patient, they were already on this medication, so I just continued it. Well, just because somebody else made a mistake doesn't mean you need to continue it and extend it. It means that it's a time for you to step in and say, well, maybe there's a better therapy. I mean, that's why you came to me, right? I mean, you come to me as a healthcare professional seeking advice and a better therapy. I want to get better. I wouldn't be here. So I have an obligation to you, and I think that we as healthcare professionals need to realize that we have that obligation to our patients today and start looking for evidence-based therapies that we can employ every day for our patients. And we will have a healthier country. We'll have healthier people. I mean, you look, we're really behind a lot of the other countries in this world just from lack of protocol-based therapies to these patients. And so that's where we need to change our thought process, our practicing processes, is to really understand that they come to us for information and to learn and become educated. That's our responsibility as healthcare professionals, is to educate that patient and help them get better, help them help themselves get better.
Yeah, perfectly said. Like so many other things in healthcare, it's like so much has happened, but yet so much has to be done. I think a good place to start is just taking each patient interaction on its own and, you know, making the most of it to, you know, one step at a time, try to improve it on a national, worldwide scale.
And Brian, the ones who do this, they're so much more gratified in their practice because I've done something for this patient. They walk away. They're going to come back to me and say, thank you. I can't tell you, I told you this. How many people have come back to us and said, thank you. Thank you for helping me, helping me understand. Thank you for taking the reins of this and helping me get off this medication. And now you're here again to all of our communities that suffer from this. You're also helping all of your communities across this country. So I think our new goal in healthcare in the future is to really start focusing back on why we got into the medical profession to begin with. I think that, you know, everybody's been guilty of exploiting patients to make money from every aspect of healthcare. And I think we've got to get back to making the patient the healthier patient in the center of our care. It's not complicated. The healthier the patient is, the lower the healthcare cost is going to be in this country. And that's our obligation. That's why we went to med school, pharmacy school. We got into the medical profession. We need to get back to our roots.
Exactly. Yeah. Couldn't have said it any better myself. I really appreciate you joining and sharing all these great insights.
Absolutely. It's totally my pleasure.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Julian.
Thank you. Thank you.